this money is more used type of that, versus on our 56309 funds we're going to receive. Ladies and gentlemen, state your presence for the record and the issues of the time.
Good morning. Michael Bone, here on behalf of the Florence Warriors Playboy Canada. I'm not going to be reserving my time this morning. The issues I'd like to focus on this appeal is that the findings made by the district court supported by substantial evidence. This was a paper transaction. There were four one-page documents which lay out the negotiations and the agreements that were part of you and what was laid out in those documents were not filed by the district court because the court made findings that were the documents was executed as a result of fraud. I respectfully submit that the finding is not supported by substantial evidence and certainly not by clear and convincing evidence. In addition, the one document does contain an exculpatory clause which leaves my client's accountability. And there's a minor issue that we raised that the district court awarded $479.62 as one of the items of damages in the judgment. That wasn't contested in the appeal, I believe, and there's probably conceded. The four documents that I refer to, there was never a finding by the district court that there was any ambiguity in regards to these documents. Because of that, the documents should be taken on your case and accordingly interpreted. The case arises out of a real estate deal back in 2004-2005. There was a record title holder, the Bedards, Mr. and Mrs. Bedard. The sellers of the transactions who were co-defendants in this case, but they're not parties to this appeal, had an interest in the property pursuant to a contract of sale, but we deemed the title as the name of the Goddards. Mr. Bonar sought to acquire the property and contracted with the sellers who had the contract on the property. ESCO was open with the owner's title. The contract was signed November of 2004. ESCO was supposed to close January 15th of 2005.
So the lawyer's title never is a preliminary title on the service owner. Is they open to ask?
So there was a preliminary title report that was done that was admitted into evidence. Mr. Bonar alleges that he never received it, which was also contradicted. But they were
is that raising the red flag as far as the title company is concerned that they're opening an escrow with wire and sellers who technically don't own the property?
Well, no, because all that would be needed would be the signature of the record title holder and the current sellers, and of course the release of the mortgage.
So you have that document from the record title holder giving the sellers an interest in the property and open escrow?
Yes. Okay. The sellers, the Tarrin brothers and Michael Bandy's, had a contract of sale that was entered into the record as one of the exhibits.
Well, I was talking about the escrow documents.
But the escrow documents are also.
But was this going to be a double escrow? I mean, meaning the title holders that they deposited, like a grant bargain sale, the escrow payable to the people that want to add the contract of sale? Or how did.
It never got that far.
Okay.
If I may. The original plan was for the January 15th. That wasn't going to happen. There was an extension of time till, I believe, February 1st. With that extension, there was also an agreement that money would be released out of the escrow to the sellers. When their second extension, there was also a release of money. And at the time of the second extension, there was an addendum written by the agent for the parties, not lawyer's title, in which it was agreed that the purchaser, Carl Bonar, was going to only purchase the interest of the sellers and take the interest in the contract, take it subject to the existing note that was held by, well, the title holders, and of course it was a mortgage in the property. So it was an agreement. He was just going to basically step into the shoes of the sellers. That was an addendum not prepared by lawyer's title. As part of that, the daughters, the contract of sale required a $2,200 per month payment on the contract of sale. So the agreement was that Barner was going to buy out their interest in full, and so the sellers in the transactions, in the transaction, would no longer have an interest in the property. Instead of their shoes, he was going to set up a second or a sub escrow and deposit an additional $11,000 into escrow, and that was going to be used to pay 5 months of the $2,200 per month that he believed that they'd taken the escrow with the record title. So the lawyer's title prepared two documents, both dated March 2nd. I refer to one as the $11,000 escrow document, and the other one as the seller's proceeds to seller document, just to clarify. The seller's proceeds to seller document basically authorized lawyer's title to distribute the proceeds, basically pay the equity to the sellers out of proceeds in escrow. This same document also has an exculpatory clause relieving the lawyer's title liability for complying with it, and also has at the bottom states that the parties understand, they read the instruction, they understand it in their entirety.
Now, I think there's a dispute as to whether the sellers and people, the recipients of the contract of sale, hold lawyer's title to prepare that document, or at least hold these proceeds from escrow. Is that correct? Or
Mr. Bonar disputed his direct examination about the meaning of this document was. The document says your directed immediate release the seller's proceeds to seller breakdown as per their separate instructions. Now there was a separate instruction with authorized lawyer's title to establish an $11,000 escrow to pay the $2,200 per month.
Well, how much money was released when you signed that document?
Approximately $140,000.
Yeah, that's the part that's kind of funny. Usually that would be done very close to the escrow, you know, like that. So I think that's where the bone of contention of this whole case is and all getting here to trial. So we're just trying to get a handle on this here. And Mr. Bonar has contended he signed that by mistake, you know, that escrow instruction.
Well, he said it was misrepresented the meaning of it. And the court made a finding of misrepresentation, but misrepresentation, there's five elements to it that all have to become by clear and convincing evidence, and there was no findings of anything other than an alleged false representation. But the representation was, according to Mr. Bonar, he was told that this document had to be signed in order to release the money to the record title holders, the daughters. And on cross-examination, I went over this very carefully with him. I said, this says sellers proceeds to sellers. Doesn't say daughters, does it? He said, no. I said, in fact, it has the sellers. Dandy isn't there and parent has the sellers. Isn't it? Correct. And he agreed to it. So when you read the document as a whole, which you're supposed to, when it's a contract, it just basically says the sellers proceeds to sellers.
But didn't the party to the contract of sales say they didn't tell the title to prepare this escrow instruction? Some dispute where it came from or
law. I mean, the escrow instruction was prepared by the lawyer's title, and we said the lawyer's title ought to be prepared on their forms.
Right.
The daughter,
the question I believe is who directed the lawyer's title to prepare that form?
Well, I'm not certain who directed them to sign it. It was signed by all parties. There was an earlier document.
Is there any testimony as to anybody that directed lawyer's title to prepare that document other than lawyer's title? Just
oh no, there was an agreement reached. Certainly the sellers directed them to do that.
To do which one now?
Don't to do both
the issues as far as the $11,000 that they were going to put in the escrow to pay the mortgage to the daughters,
right?
Or each money to the daughters. Then there's the other one that directs the entire escrow fund to be released.
Correct.
Okay, so let's break it down.
Okay. Well, the escrow fund should be released. There was an earlier agreement that was not prepared by lawyer's title, but was prepared by the agents to the party. That was signed 2 weeks earlier. It was signed by Mr. Dandy's on the 19th and Mr. Perrin on the 18th of February. And it says specifically, buyer Carl Bonar to assume existing loan and property and to pay the difference to the sellers in cash. escrow company to assess the fire and set up a collection account for the existing loan on the above property. Payment for the existing loan are to be paid on this collection account. Now, I think the critical document, you know, our lawyer's title position is that instruction to pay seller's proceeds to seller, which was signed by Carl Bonar, and who under cross-examination acknowledged that he read the entire document and he understood what it meant, and he certified that by his signature.
Is it your instruction to the record? Do you understand? Didn't he say he made a phone call to the lawyer's title for an explanation? And based upon that information, he signed the document?
That's what he said, yes. But on he said he was his understanding.
We have what you represented. We also have this other part of the record also. Is that not correct?
That is correct. But on cross examination, I went through the document with him.
And the person that he allegedly talked to did not testify at the stitch cut. Is that not correct?
That is also not. That is also correct. That person was not employed by the lawyer's title. Not be looking. But the document is clear on his face.
So, let me come back.
Sure.
Justice Gibbons asked a question. Justice Perry attempted to correct me. Do we understand why that secondary instruction was prepared by the lawyer's title?
Yes. So if you read the instruction, it is clear, and I clarified with Mr. Bonar on cross-examination, seller's proceeds were to be paid to sellers, and the document notes that he is the buyer, and the sellers were the people who had the contract to sell.
From your standpoint, does it clarify your examination of the parties who did testify as to who authorized that secondary instruction to be prepared?
Well, it's not so much who authorized it to be prepared.
Well, that's the question we ask.
Well,
you answer
it. I understand, and I apologize. You can prepare any document, it's who signed it.
Yeah, the question is who asked for it, because this is a kind of thing. Very active. We have some other parties who are coming into your office, not so that was the question we were just playing with as we were attempting to examine this.
And I was respectfully.
Answer it. Please do something you can't, as far as you can't answer.
I'm not certain. Well, there was both parties who had agreed to this, and that is shown by three documents, the February 18th amendment.
But we seem to have this role of instruction, which no one seems to want to lay claim to, that was done by the title company. So the question is who asked the title company? Do they do it on their own initiative, or do they show in their records where they point back to someone else and they call them to ask us to do this?
That, there was no note in the escrow files who told them to do this. I believe the sellers did testify that this was the agreement of the parties, and Mr. Bonner's agreement to the terms is shown by his signature and his acknowledgement on cross-examination that he read it and understood what it meant.
Now, there was a question I had as well, as far as him parking his $134,000 or whatever it was in that escrow account. Was there an escrow instruction that directed him to do that?
Well, you don't need an instruction to do something on your own. First, the part of the
instruction. And I guess my question behind that is, why in the world would he ever do that? Unless there was an instruction that directed him to do it that would procure some benefit.
He was buying the seller's interest, and this money was deposited to buy their interest and to pay the proceeds.
Did he ever determine up front what the cost of what the amount of that interest would be?
It was approximately under $38,000. And that was the
price. How much did he pay prior to this? Didn't he?
I think it was a $25,000 to $45,000 that was distributed previously.
$25,000 and then $45,000.
On top of this.
On top of this.
Yes. The critical document is that 5 days later, Mr. Bonar signed a memorandum as an affidavit, basically the cloud title, to show he had an interest in this property. And it says specifically he has purchased their interest. It says the deal was consummated. The deal was closed on March 2nd. That's when he put the money in. That's when he signed the document. That's when he signed the other documents. It says there that I will deposit additional $11,000 with the title company. I will maintain 2 months of impound with it. And I am going to place the funds into escrow fee service by lawyer's title. these are all future acts. What happened after this happened, he did not place an additional $11,000 into the escrow. The seller refused to go forward with the sale. They canceled escrow. And he has a claim against them for money, but as far as the lawyer's title is concerned, we were directed to disperse the funds. It's clear, it's in writing, and we are absolved. We're supposed to do as we are directed to do.
He didn't deposit $11,000, but he did deposit $134,000.
Correct. And he was supposed to deposit the additional $11,000 on or before.
He wasn't required to deposit $134,000, so how could the $11,000 be an additional?
Well, he admits that it was an additional in his affidavit. Because after the money was deposited, he was supposed to, you know, 5 days after he made that deposit, he reported this affidavit, which is, I am going to deposit another additional money into escrow.
Can I ask two more questions, Mr. Cohen? Again, we're trying to get a handle on the facts. It's kind of an unusual real estate transaction here. But I assume this whole thing was structured, at least it didn't come out of the trial, because suppose they're due on sale clause in the first trustee here, and that's why they have this contract to sale.
I don't think that was an issue.
That wasn't it. Okay. No. Second question then is, what was the total purchase price for the property for Mr. Bonar? If he took over the contract of sale, would you get the legal title to the house? What was the total consideration for that? I know he agreed to take over the contract of sale. I understand that. But when you buy a contract of sale, you're buying a lawsuit for specific performance, unless you've got a deal here that was part of it to get title to the property. So what was the total deal, you know, so he could eventually get title?
Well, he was buying out the mortgage was $167,000.
Okay.
About $130,000 on top of that owed to the daughters for their equity in the property.
So it's about $300,000 deal.
Well, there's $300,000 for a daughter and the mortgage company.
Right. That was gross. That's the gross amount.
Right. Plus the seller's equity interest in the property of the approximately $70,000 plus the other $140,000. So the equity for the sellers was about $200,000, which is what was distributed to them through us.
Okay. Very good. Maybe, thank you. Maybe Mr. Rosenberg can help us out.
Thank you.
Mr. Rosenberg,
if you want to. Did you want to talk to him?
I
just asked if you had since you didn't reserve your title of views, like some of your time, did you have included your books that you don't have to use?
No, I will be brief. The bottom line is, if you read over these documents as a whole, which you are permitted to, it lays out what the transaction was supposed to be. As far as the lawyer's title is concerned, we're supposed, as the independent, neutral third party, we're supposed to follow the instructions of the parties. We had written instructions to disperse seller's proceeds. We disperse seller's proceeds. There is a exculpatory clause in there saying you can't hold us liable if something happens and the sale isn't closed. There's something wrong with the title. That's an additional ground to our dealer's liability.
One question, Your Honor. The exculpatory clause, did that come from the mystery instruction?
Well, that
doesn't really know where it came from.
No, that is right in the one instruction that says seller's proceeds will be paid to sellers. And that is a standard instruction used by most title companies when they're releasing money from escrow earlier. And it says, you know, escrow may not close, you may lose your money, we don't know what to say to the title, these things may come up, but we're going to listen to you and disperse the money. We don't want you to come back and complain later. If for any other reason, escrow does not close.
In that case, you were listening to the sellers who requested that instruction be
okay. Well, when you say we listened, this is a mutual instruction agreed to and signed by both parties. The standard in the Broussard case and the other escrow cases are we have to abide by mutual written instruction, mutual instructions by the parties. More times than not, they are written. So if we were directed by one side to prepare it, but the other side signs it, they have agreed to those terms.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning, and please the court. It's always a privilege to be here and try to explain a little bit of this from the perspective of Mr. Bowman, who's here before the argument. There are two major facts that I think all of you see that are critical to understanding what happened during the period of time that these escrow instructions were being circulated and what happened at trial. The first fact is Alice Garland doesn't live here anymore. Alice Garland is the person who did this on behalf of Blair's title. Alice Garland was never identified as a witness. We could never find her. She left Blair's title shortly after these escrow events occurred. We asked for a 30B6 requirement during discovery. We got the guy who was somehow involved with claims, and he didn't know anything about this file. At trial, we had a different person who wasn't even identified to the 16.1 disclosure, who didn't even work at Blair's title at the time these events occurred. So there was no defense, basically, for Blair's title as to what happened here.
Well, let me start with this court, and they say that I checked out the comment. I said, we want the court to only look at the documents.
Well, but
the documents were signed by Al Hartman.
Yeah, but the problem is Justice Sherry made a specific finding that that last instruction, the rogue instruction, as you call it, was signed based upon a misrepresentation by Alice Garland. There's uncontradicted evidence of that misrepresentation.
Well, nonetheless, the documents were signed by both parties. So what is it going to do with the document that Hartman did with the signature? The fact is,
yeah, but he signed it only based upon the misrepresentation of Ms. Garland that that instruction was necessary to disperse the $2,200 per month that would go out for the next 6 months or until the escrow closed. That was the representation. There's no testimony other than that about her representations, and that's what Justice Shearing based her finding of, first of all, of the fraudulent collusion with the sellers, number one. That was her first claim. Second claim was she found that that misrepresentation to Mr. Bonar was a breach of fiduciary duty because she had to know that that was false because the very same day she dispersed $140,000 to the sellers.
Was there any evidence at the trial that the sellers paid some sort of money to Ms. Garland or something for her involvement in this transaction?
There was no evidence of that. You know, the only thing that's even remotely close to that is that Mr. Bonds, one of the sellers, subsequently married Alice Garland's assistant. That's in the record. And married her later that year. So there was a little bit of a suggestion there, but I leave that up to you as to what way to get that. The problem that Mr. Bone has is he disregards Justice Sharon's written decision. She wrote that herself. It has three separate reasons or three separate claims for which she entered the judgment. The fraudulent collusion, which was the uncontradicted testimony from Mr. Bonar that Alice Garland said, you have to sign this instruction in order for us to pay out the $2,200 a month to the daughters. That's why he signed it. He didn't sign it with the understanding, and there's no evidence that he signed it with the understanding that she was then going to release every bit of money that was in that escrow account. Secondly, she found that that misrepresentation was a breach of fiduciary duty, making that misrepresentation to Mr. Bonar. Again, there's no evidence to contradict that. It is uncontradicted evidence. Mr. Bonar's breach refers to as uncorroborated. It's not uncorroborated, it's uncontradicted, because Alice Garland doesn't live here anymore. The third basis that Justice Shearing had was the unilateral cancellation of the escrow. At the end of the month, Alice Garland just unilaterally canceled the escrow at the direction of the sellers. Is there any evidence in your file that they notified Mr. Bonar or got his signature on a cancellation instruction? No. There's a fax sheet that's made out to Mr. Bonar's fax number, there wasn't his fax number anymore. That's it. I mean, if you got $150,000 sitting in an escrow, one would think that a title company had a little bit more of a duty to try and contact you if they're going to close out an escrow and terminate your right to $219,000 worth of cash. This court has said repeatedly that the trier of fact is the one who evaluates the credibility of witnesses, who observes the witnesses, who decides what weight to give to each of the witnesses' testimony. And that's what Justice Shearing did. Justice Shearing heard from Mr. Bolinar, she heard from Mr. Bonzi, and both of the Perron brothers. And she made certain findings of fact. And unless those findings are clearly erroneous, then this court has said we're not going to direct the district court to believe this testimony and not believe that testimony. That's the law as it is stated in this court. Now, in this case, that's where the Alice Garland thing comes up again. There's no contradictory evidence to the fact that my client signed that instruction based upon a misrepresentation of an escrow officer. And the escrow officer wasn't, didn't come to trial, didn't do anything, was gone. Now, the argument that Mr. Bowen makes is that there's insufficient evidence. I've been to the Nevada Supreme Court enough times to know that's not usually a very good argument to make. He tries to stretch that into a straw man argument about fraud and the elements of fraud and the five elements and all that. He misses the point. Justice Shearing made two separate findings of breaches of fiduciary duty. One, the misrepresentation itself was a breach of fiduciary duty. Two, the unilateral cancellation of escrow was a breach of fiduciary duty. Mr. Bonar and his partners lost $219,000 in this transaction. $140,000 roughly that went out the same day that Alice Garland made this misrepresentation. Plus, they'd already released $77,500.
Why did your clients do this, agree to buy this contract of sale versus wanting to close escrow and title of the property?
Because the clients were still ready to close another transaction and they needed some more time. They didn't think it would be that long, but they needed some more time. So they talked in February when there were discussions. That's when my clients found out that these guys didn't even own the property. They'd never gotten a preliminary title report. They testified to that at trial. There's no evidence in the file that the lawyer's title report they ever sent. He found out about that in February. There was a discussion about my client assuming the contract of the Perron brothers and Bonzi. The problem is, as it was testified to Mr. Perron and his brother, both said that the Goddards wouldn't take my clients. They wouldn't allow my clients to take over the contract. There's conflicting evidence at trial. Mr. Bonzi says, oh yeah, the Goddards, they were in on it. They would do it. And both Perron brothers said it was our understanding that they wouldn't do it. So that's why we have the agreement on March 2nd that my client is going to put in $11,000. It's going to go out $2,200 a month. And then at the end of the escrow, the rest of the money would be paid. They had parked some funds in there.
So what happens at the end of the escrow? Would they have gotten just the interest in the contract sale? See, that's what this transaction is so goofy. You know, I just don't get it why people are throwing this kind of money around here with this title and this kind of condition and all of that. Maybe this is irrelevant to the issues here today, but we're trying to understand this, why it happened.
There is nothing in writing in this escrow that would say what would happen if it closed the escrow.
So your client would just pay a bunch of money at the close of escrow and have what? You know, like
that. The second fact that said you needed to understand in order to see how these events occurred was in 04 and 05, real estate was rolling down the street. I mean, there were so many transactions happening so fast that the title companies were deluged with this stuff. Real estate investors and developers were moving, flipping, shaking, doing everything with property at that time. And things, steps were skipped, but they're not supposed to be skipped by the title company. They're just not. And frankly, from the escrow instructions and from the paper, I believe it was the intent that my clients would take title upon their deposit of $475,000, they would be entitled to the property and the contract would be made up. If that were true, we've already heard from Mr. Bone today that, that the Goddards had $167,000, note on the property, plus they were due another $130,000 under the contract, so that's $300,000. So there's $175,000 owed, I guess, as the balance to these guys, to the sellers, and somehow they walked away with $219,000. And that's because there is nothing in the escrow file that would ever tell us how you would calculate what the seller's proceeds would be. How could there be proceeds if there was no sale? I mean, the whole thing is just such a mess that wasn't properly supervised by lawyer's title.
Mr. Rosenberg, it sounds like your clients are pretty sophisticated, though, and they can make one phone call to the Clark County Treasurer's Office, and they can tell you who owns the title to that property based on the address. I mean, this isn't like rocket science to find this stuff out, and we have this mystery of who owns it. So it just kind of baffles me. I know hindsight's wonderful, but still, throwing this kind of money around, you don't even know who owns the property, seems, at least to the three of us, seems like the world is kind of out there.
Well, one would think that the seller's agents who brought these people together, Mr. Hamill, who is also a friend of Mr. Bonar's, would have disclosed something in that regard as well. But that wasn't.
Yeah, if you take a listing on the property, I assume. Whoever gives you the listing has to own it, you know.
Mr. Rosenberg, the application for exculpatory clause opinion to this transaction for the state.
Well, Your Honor, in that case that I cited, I believe it's called Davis versus Nevada National Bank, it's the closest thing I can find in Nevada. There are cases elsewhere in other states where the Supreme Courts have just said, you know, if you put an exculpatory provision in a contract and you violate some duty at law that isn't created by the agreement, then that's void against public policy. In this Nevada National Bank case, what happened was the loan proceeds were distributed when they shouldn't have been. And the bank said, oh, look, down here there's this little line that says we're not responsible. And this court said, no, we're not saying that you can get out of it. If you've got a duty otherwise, not created by this agreement, then you can't use that exculpatory provision. And that's what they say in other states as well. In this case, we've got fiduciary duties on the part of the title company that are created by cases decided by this court. And those duties were violated according to Justice Shearing. And then the title company comes back. Here's down here, there's the exculpatory provision. Interesting question, why don't some of these other instructions have that exculpatory provision? It's only the rogue instruction that has that exculpatory provision. In California, they just void these things if there's a breach of fiduciary duty or fraud involved, they void the exculpatory provision. And that's what I think this court should do. It should follow the Davis versus Nevada National Bank case. And that's how this case should be decided as well.
What about the damage calculation?
$476, I think Mr. Bone is correct about that. I don't have an argument.
And any other issues on damages besides this $476?
Well, only that my client should have gotten more. And if you wanted to hear about that, I can tell you.
Well, you didn't do a prosecution.
No, I didn't.
Okay, well, I guess I can't hear about it.
In any case, the Justice Shearing reviewed all the evidence, saw the witnesses, made factual determinations based upon the evidence. It's not this court's province, according to its prior cases, to direct the district court, you believe this witness but not that witness, and you believe this and but not that. She made findings regarding this fraudulent misrepresentation. There are three different bases, even in the synopsis that was prepared by the court staff for today's argument, it talks about three separate bases to support the judgment in this case, and that would be the two breaches of fiduciary duty that Justice Shearing found, and the fraudulent collusion with the sellers to release these funds prematurely. And my client is out $219,000 right now, whereas if the instructions would have been fair and would have been accurately performed by Lawyer's Title. My client was there in April with the funds to close the escrow. That's when he was told it was canceled without his knowledge. So I think there's enough basis on all three of the claims to sustain the judgment that was entered by Justice Sherry, and I would ask the court to do that.
That requires the argument to sustain, and she'll be able to hear the court has to sustain.